Hello, and welcome to the Indie Dev Podcast. I'm your host, David Voiles, and with me this week is Sean Colombo. Sean has been making games for 15 years. After quitting college to run web startup LyricWiki, he sold the site to Wikia in 2009. A couple years later, he founded Blue Line Games to focus on making digital versions of award-winning board games. Blue Line's flagship games, Hive and Ket 2.0, are currently the top two rated board games among the 80 that are on Steam. Currently, Blue Line is working on a Steam version of a famous Euro game and updating all four of its Steam titles, which includes a free-to-play Simply Chess. Sean, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
All right, so you guys are definitely taking a different angle into game development, or at least creating games, than I think most people end up going. And by that, I mean, you know, people seem to have a passion for, hey, I'm going to make my really original idea out there. I'm going to make it a side-scrolling platformer, or I love World of Warcraft. I'm going to make the next MMO. But yours are based more around traditional board games. So how did you get started in that kind of idea of creating board games as opposed to, you know, platformers or other genres?
So when I was doing web stuff, it was actually always on my mind that I was going to go back to games eventually. And so I would read as much as I could about the game industry and what was working and what wasn't. And what it seemed to me was that almost all the indie devs would make one game and then it wouldn't make enough money and then they'd be out of the industry. So that didn't sound terribly appealing. So I wanted to go for a strategy that would let us kind of survive and build up a base of very small, lower risk, lower reward, but like more certain games, so that all we had to do is execute on them well,
right?
Which is, you know, something we were getting pretty good at, actually shipping stuff.
That's a skill in and of itself.
Yeah. So the strategy was to do that and have enough money, and then we could survive and eventually make our own more ambitious things. And you know, if they didn't work, we wouldn't be out of the industry as soon as we failed one time.
Right, right. So it's kind of idea you're almost hedging your bets, but at the same time you're saying, hey, here's what we know will likely make money. So why don't we focus on something that we know we can create a business out of, and then later on we can focus on the things that we really want to do, right? Like the personal passion projects.
Yep. So I mean, we have some of those going off in the background, and as far as like, you know, a game that we thought we could make money, it also like lined up really well with our skills. I'd realized that most of the games I'd been making my whole life were actually turn-based strategy.
Okay.
Anyway,
so it fit in well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So can you give us a bit about your background? I mean, like I said, you had run a web startup, LyricWiki. How did you get into that, and how did you get into programming as a whole?
I think getting into programming mainly started as boredom in high school. We had these TI-83 calculators.
Where did you go to school? Like which area?
Hampton Heights in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Pennsylvania. Yeah. So, I was just bored and they had these calculators that were programmable. And then very soon it became obvious to me I could actually do stuff. And that's like one of the worst things about high school. You just can't do anything. You just sit in a chair and do nothing all day.
It's kind of like you're doing what everyone else is telling you to do.
Yeah. And like very little of it, right? Like you have to do the slowest, the class goes at the speed of the slowest person in it.
Exactly.
So it felt very restrictive, and just in general as a teenager, you feel powerless. And then like I was able to make games that I could share to people, and it felt really powerful and enjoyable. And I was really into a bunch of abstract math problems too, and I found I could do a lot more with computers with those. So it just kind of swelled from there.
Okay, so like a combination of a number of your passions, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice. Okay. So you started with the Text Instruments Calculator, which I think is actually a lot of developers got started too, right? You could see that you could create, Snake or little Pac-Man-like games inside of it.
Yep.
So that sparked your interest. Then did you have a traditional background in programming? I mean, did you go to school for it, or was it the kind of thing you learned on your own?
I did a lot of it in high school. So by the time I went to college, I went to RIT.
Oh, very smart man. So RIT is in New York, for those who are not in the know.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. That environment was fantastic.
You like the cold between Pittsburgh and RIT.
Oh, God. Well, now I'm in the South, in North Carolina, so yeah. I eventually wore out of those winters, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, but so I had made a bunch of games before I went to college, and then I made a bunch more in college. I mean, I wasn't... Even at that time, I wasn't planning to go into games, but it's still... They're just really fun to make.
Okay.
And yeah, I did 4 years at RIT. It's a 5-year program, though.
Oh, wow. So, computer science?
Yep, I was in computer science. And my co-founder of Blue Line, Jeff Brown, he went to RIT also.
Okay.
And he was in software engineering, which is similar. but, you know, it's got a slightly different focus.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring that up, because I recently read an article about a disgruntled former Temple University student who was upset at the lack of programming classes within her computer science degree. And a lot of people who have the comments on this story, it was from Technically Philly, which is like a local tech and startup scene blog for major cities. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were commenting that computer science and software engineering or programming are two different things. And I think you touched on something very important there, right? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people go to school for computer science thinking you're going to program all day and write front-end applications for mobile devices, but in reality, computer science, right, is the understanding or comprehension of how computers work, both in the engineering and on the software side, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot more like algorithmics, and I was really into cryptography.
Oh, nice.
At that time. And
a huge market for that right now, too.
Yeah, it's good to know, at least to have someone on your team who's good with it, mm-hmm. Because it ends up coming up in almost everything. Last ECGC, which I think is the last time I ran into you.
Yep. Can you explain what ECGC is?
It's a East Coast Game Conference. It's the big conference every year in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yep.
And it's been growing pretty fast.
Yeah, great place for students or people who want to get into game development or people who want to showcase their titles. It's would you say more one of the more personal game development events or conferences in the country?
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
So yeah, I gave a talk there on cryptography for game developers mm-hmm. because it had a pretty good turnout. And I think a large part of that's because it's something that, you know, is pretty in depth and time consuming. So a lot of game developers didn't have time to get into it. So I was just kind of lucky that was one of my focuses. So,
yeah. And so what is a practical use case of cryptography in game development?
One of the bigger ones is making clients and servers talk to each other.
Yep.
Things like that, storing progress locally, if you don't want someone to be able to mess with it, things like that.
Right. So it's largely help prevent cheating and keep the game on your terms instead of somebody else's, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not even just keeping people from cheating on their own, but, you know, preventing people from hacking each other and causing chaos for, removing someone else's work, those sort of things.
Right. Yeah. And that's going to essentially ruin the experience for someone else, which in turn will cost you money or bad PR mm-hmm. and things like that.
Yeah, so it's not even one of those features you can add for fun. It's one of those things that you, depending on what features you're adding in your game, you might have to do it.
Right, so, right.
Yeah.
That's understandable.
Another thing we did in CS, in computer science, that was different was we did a lot of performance-related stuff and, like, deep combinatorics-type theory, and that stuff came into play a lot.
What is that?
In our AI. It just has to deal with complexity of algorithms.
Okay.
Stuff. So we do a lot of AI for our board games.
Mm-hmm.
And processing, you know, millions of nodes per second, it takes some pretty clever tricks to.
That's right. Yeah, there's like a finite outcome for these results. And I saw recently a speed comparison. I'm like big into web development. I've been looking at things like Asm.js, so assembly JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And a popular thing that's caught on are people taking chess algorithms, right? You can determine the best moves in chess, right? Because mm-hmm. The thing about that is there's only so many options that are available and move sets that are available. So what it'll do is it'll quickly run through every possible solution or permutation of the game and kind of decide what's best. So even on the Edge team at Microsoft, we have a cool demo online where it's running it through a an algorithm to solve a chess game to compare the speed of JavaScript versus assembly JavaScript or ASM.js. And it's interesting to see how quickly it can process that information. But AI is definitely something that's quite a bit of work. So would you mind touching on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. A whole bunch of turn-based strategy games, they all use the same general theory of, you look at all the possible board positions from the current state, like what moves people could do. And then from there, you look at all the moves that the next player could do and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And there's an algorithm called Minimax, which is something we had to implement in our engine. And we actually had to make it extremely efficient. There's a bunch of efficiency upgrades that people have discovered over the decades. And we pretty much had to do all of them because our first release was on the Xbox 360.
Yep. And that was which platform or service?
That was Xbox Live Indie Games.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which was one thing I didn't realize about the 360 is that because it was released so long ago and the hardware stayed constant the whole time, It was actually less powerful than my cell phone at the time I was writing this game. Because I did it, towards the end of the Xbox Live Indie Game days. And there was another issue too, is that memory they'd trigger a garbage collect every meg that you allocated. I'd allocate 150 megs a second.
Yeah, so you're getting stutters and hangups all the time.
Yeah. So we had to pool all of our memory and it was a giant rewrite.
So that was because XNA was in C#, and they have a garbage collector for you. Right. Whereas if you'd done something in something like C++, you can handle the garbage collection yourself, right?
Yeah. So we ended up basically removing the benefit of C#.
Yeah.
And doing our own memory pooling. But that's only in the version of the .NET runtime that was on the Xbox. The PC version doesn't collect every meg. I think it's every 100 megs or something.
Yeah, you're right. There were quite a few differences between the two that I noticed along the way, too.
Yeah. But that's kind of a thing of the past for us now because we're all on PC, Mac, and Linux. Mm-hmm. But we still have the memory pooling in there, so it might make it slightly faster.
Okay. And what are you writing your games in now? You're writing for XNA and C# when you're doing the 360. And mm-hmm. what is it today?
We actually kept with the same code base. And then so we followed the kind of the evolution of Monogame, which picked up kind of an open source implementation of the XNA API.
Okay.
And then we followed that through to FNA, which is kind of a successor to that. It was forked from Monogame.
Yep.
And its focus is to be strictly XNA API compliant, so that if you have a game that was written in XNA, it would port almost instantly to PC, Mac, and Linux.
Wow, nice. So it'll handle all the DirectX and OpenGL calls for you, and you're essentially just writing your gameplay code.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah. It's it's pretty low level compared to something like Unity, but it's been pretty good for us. I mean, the drawback is I can't go in the asset store and buy scrollable chat frame.
You're essentially writing your own tools and parts of your application yourself, right?
Yeah, yeah. But over time, it's becoming easier. And that's one of the benefits, too, of doing a whole bunch of games that are similar in nature is every time we do a new one, we've been adding more to the game engine so that we can release updates to games. And I mean, the Hive that you buy now on Steam is, a lot more feature-rich and polished than it was when we released it.
Yep.
it's a lot of game for $10 now.
You raise a good point there. So there's two things I want to discuss, and you can decide which path you want to take this. Mm-hmm. The first was, why did you choose to stick with something like XNA, FNA? Did it have to do with the fact you had written so much of this code already and your tools were there? And another question is, which we can probably handle later, but I want to bring up now so I don't forget. Do you see value in continuing to support your games after launch, right? With either DLC or free editions or continuing to improve the AI and whatnot?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll answer the FNA one first, I guess. So when we were switching over to Windows, Mac, and Linux, we looked at Unity and Unreal.
How long ago was this?
2-3 years now.
Okay, so it's Unreal UDK, right? So Unreal Engine 3 and Unity 3 something probably.
Yeah, and we've reevaluated now and then, but because they're actually both of those are also written in C#.
Yep.
So we wouldn't lose everything. So one of the main things that kept us on something like FNA is that FNA's writing code, like, first and foremost.
Yep.
And so our games are very code heavy, being like with all this AI engine and stuff in them.
Right.
So if you use something like Unity, you're kind of, everything's kind of starting at the front end with the game objects and the graphics associated with them, and then you're kind of pumping code into the
right. So you have a bit of overhead to begin with.
Yeah. So it'd be a little bit of a struggle. There's a big learning curve, and I definitely think most people are probably better suited to grab something like Unity because there's so many use cases that it covers right now.
Right. Like, out of the box, you're ready to go.
Yeah. I mean, you could do a first-person shooter, like a demo of it, in such an absurdly short amount of time. It's, yep, it's pretty amazing. But
yeah, it's wild to see like how it's changed even in a handful of years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think having our code base that we'd been working on for so long, and the AI engine was pretty advanced by the time we switched over to Windows, Mac, Linux.
Okay.
I think the code base is what tipped it for us to make it so that FNA was definitely still the right choice.
Okay.
And we did an experiment, and we had a port of, or I think Jeff took like 1 or 2 days, and then he had it running on FNA. So we're like, okay.
So. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I've seen a lot of people kind of go back and forth and say, oh, I'll stick with XNA or I'll go to Unity, or they tried writing wrappers and whatnot, and it just wasn't quite there for them. So it's interesting to see, like, you know, some people stick with it, other people go. And I know that even studios like Ska Studios is still using XNA, really mono game now, to write, you know, for PS4 and other platforms too. So that's a question I always ask developers, is which tool are they using and why? And that's largely because everyone wants, you know, whatever suits them at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then how about in terms of continuing support for an application after the initial launch? Do you see value in that? And if so, why or why not?
I definitely see value in that. Fortunately, too, because as a developer and a gamer, it's that's the answer you kind of want to be true, right?
Yep.
Like, you don't want people to just release games and then abandon them.
Right.
But I do think that from a business standpoint, it does make sense too. So if you look at games like Killing Floor,
yep,
the money that they made was, you know, over the long haul. And I actually saw a presentation from one of the Killing Floor guys at the first ECGC I went to, which would have been like 2013 or something.
Yep.
Or maybe earlier than that. But and he just showed the charts and how, like, you know, they just kept adding free stuff, and the free stuff would drive the sales of other things.
Right.
And we found in our games that's definitely been the case too. So Hive has been out for just over 2 years now. I just did a pretty extensive postmortem.
I'm looking at this right now, yeah.
The one on Gamma Sutra.
Year one versus year two.
Yeah. So it...
This is on your blog, by the way. So people go to BlueLineGameStudios.com, they can reference this post, which I also have in the our post later today too.
Nice. Yeah. So I mean, it was good to see those sales go up year over year, and the type of game we make lends itself really well to that. Like, we're choosing board games that have a ton of replay value, so mm-hmm. ideally the people who start playing it will still be generally around the community later on. So the community should kind of snowball, and the gameplay itself won't get old. So like, it's not the kind of thing that when a new game comes out, it's going to get outmoded. Like, with FPSs, there's a bit of a, what do you call that? Arms race. So
yeah.
Like, an arms race with graphics and features and things. So
yep.
Like, now if you can't dual wield in an FPS, or you can't hop into vehicles, like, the game is dated and it's kind of like,
Right.
So it that doesn't really happen with turn-based strategy games so much. So we've been really lucky in that regard. We've released a ton of updates. And I mean, I just released one for Ket last night,
yep,
to add Spanish and Turkish translations.
Wow, nice. So, like, all of a sudden you've opened up to an entire new market.
Yeah, I'm hoping it'll make some difference. I think someone did a Russian translation a little while ago.
Like, so a fan did this?
Yeah.
Wow, nice.
It's just volunteers for all their translations so far.
Wow, it says a lot about the community, huh?
Yeah, they're really helpful, and that's been great. And especially because, you know, Russian was the first translation we did, so it was kind of a mess. Like, this guy had to work with me to, like, figure out which strings hadn't even been put into the internationalization system yet, and things like that.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, so you guys are really getting diving in with both hands.
Yeah, and, you know, it should be a lot smoother now. The Turkish file took me like 15 minutes to like tweak some line breaks and everything was perfect.
So I have a new market available to you.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people who don't speak English as it turns out.
Who would have thought, right?
Yeah. Or don't want to, you know?
Yeah.
Like if you're learning it, it's hard to, you don't want your relaxation time to be trying to figure out what some board game's telling you.
Exactly. So we're talking about community support, and now you said you had another developer help you port this over to Russian, and now you have this in Turkish. So you do see value in even getting things like that going too. So it says a lot about your community, the fact that you're getting them to continue to help you along the way, and again, like for free, right? They get nothing out of this short mm-hmm. of perhaps learning a little bit. And I can see on the sales chart that you have over time, year one versus year two, generally, developers, right, they'll see a decline immediately after launch within a few months, right? But look at this. It looks like you've sold just as much, if not more, in year two, but particularly at the end of the year, right, you surpassed in year two what you were selling at year one. So that says a lot. And what do you think was the cause of that?
There were a few causes. Mainly it was we got better at understanding that sales are the biggest way for visibility on Steam. And they do really well if you pair them with updates. So we kept releasing a ton of updates. And one of the more effective ones was we introduced asynchronous play.
Oh, nice.
Which is a cool feature as a feature, but like as a community building thing, it's very, very important. So one of the biggest challenges of all of these types of games is having enough people online so that when some random person comes on to play a game, there's someone there to play with.
Right.
And async is what kind of put that over the edge, because it's kind of like a single tipping point there where like someone will pop on, they'll see no one else on, they're like, oh, no one's here. So they leave.
Right. Immediately. Exactly.
And with async, there was always these games sticking around. So someone would come on, they'd join a game, and then they themselves would now be hanging out in the online system.
Gotcha. Okay, so someone wouldn't have to be there right away, but they could still play.
Mm-hmm. And that just made the entire online community start growing and growing. So now there is way more likely to be someone online at any given moment.
Nice.
So that was a hugely beneficial update. But, I mean, we just kept, every time we did another game, because we did Hive, then Ket, then Reversi, then Simply Chess.
Okay, so you have four games out at this point.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and have you seen that, you know, using an older game to support or promote a newer game works well too?
Mm-hmm, pretty well. There's about a 16% overlap, like Hive players.
Yep.
16% of Hive players on Ket.
Okay. And, nice.
And vice versa and things like that. So that's a pretty high crossover, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, it's like you already have these customers, these users, and obviously customer retention is always far cheaper and more effective than having to go out and acquire new customers. And it's like that, not just for games, but anything in the startup or world out there. So I think you stumbled across something very neat there, too. Do you have anything else during this postmortem that you'd like to share as well, or lessons learned along the way?
Man,
like, so DLC, it looks like didn't get a ton of a boost there. But then how about Mac and Linux launches? Because it appears you launched on Windows first. And seems like Hive units sold by platform. So it seems like Windows sold about 90% with Mac at about 6.5% and Linux. I'm surprised that anyone's using Linux outside of work environment at about 3.5%. So in terms of the, time or effort ratio, was it I should say time and effort versus adoption, do you think it was worth it for you to build these Mac and Linux ports or why not?
Yep. It turns out, so when I made the blog post, that I actually didn't have some information that I now have more recently stumbled upon, and that is how long I spent on them as a percentage of my dev time.
Oh, nice.
So I found out that over between Reversi and Simply Chess, it was about 5%.
Wow,
of my time was spent doing the ports and then supporting them, even though
it looks like you got about 10% a new audience, though.
Yeah, over it was around 11% or around 12% of the revenue.
Yeah.
So 5% of the work.
Yeah, high revenue by platform. Yeah, so 5% of the work, 12% of the revenue. Not a bad trade-off, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, technically it was per hour better than just doing another Windows game, for example, and skipping. So that's nice, because you know, I'd feel stupid otherwise, because I've always been like really into supporting wide groups of people, and it worked out.
And then in terms of other big learnings here, you highlight things like full launch is better than early access. Why is that?
It got a lot more visibility on Steam, for one. And I think another part of it is people see early access and only a small percentage of customers want to deal with everything that comes with, because it, you know, it typically will involve having to do bug reports and not knowing when full version will be out, things like that.
Yeah, so, they're kind of like holding their breath, patiently waiting.
Yeah, so early access was a great way to get some QA. It probably should have done that for SimplyChess, but I had no idea how popular that was going to be.
Hindsight is always 20/20, right?
Yeah. We had 100,000 SimplyChess players in the first couple of days.
Wow, nice.
And
does this have to do with the chess community as a whole? Like, is it still wildly popular, or?
There just hasn't been like a game on chess where you, or on Steam where you just play chess. Like, they've had some battle chesses.
I was going to say, like, I'm thinking Star Wars battle chess.
Yeah. So there's been that kind of thing, but there hasn't just been like a chess game, and it's, you know, like really full featured, and the expectations on chess are subconsciously. Because people want every feature they've ever seen for chess, and they want it in every game, which isn't possible. Like,
right.
The only reason we were able to make Simply Chess so full featured was because we'd spent years on this engine.
Yep.
So there's this, I mean, if you quantified how much money it would take to make Simply Chess from scratch, I mean, it's hundreds of thousands, and we gave it away for free. So that's why there isn't another one. But
You raised another good point there. You know, we had console launches 2 years ago, and I work at Microsoft, and we had Xbox One come out. And an issue that I saw a lot of people vocalize was they're saying, hey, a lot of the features I had on Xbox Live, my 360, are not here on Xbox One. Why? And it was the same reasons what you're saying here, is that that version of Xbox Live was almost 10 years old at that point. So it's difficult to suddenly recreate 10 years of work for a launch of a next generation, right? Like, it takes time to get back to that starting point again, especially when you're rewriting everything from scratch.
Yeah.
So you raise a very good point there. And then finally, about community, right? Another key point you have here is keep grinding to build the online community, especially if it has multiplayer, right? So we touched a bit about this, but do you have any final key points you'd like to talk about? Tips and tricks for keeping or building a community online?
I guess don't get discouraged, because early on in the community building days, the size of the community was essentially zero, right? Like, there was a long time where we would, and this async release that that we made that actually made the online finally hit the tipping point, that was like my fourth attempt to get the online to hit the tipping point.
And so you're not going to do it your first time out of the gate.
Yeah, I mean, we had to try so many things, and, you know, it's one of those things where, I mean, if your game is good, which it, you know, we knew it was based on the reviews, and it had a lot of people playing it for a lot of hours. So it wasn't the game that was the problem. It had to be our online features. So we just kept iterating to figure out like what could keep people around longer, and make them be able to see each other and things like that. And
And did you offer a way for the players to communicate? I mean, is there a forum or anything of that nature?
All the Steam games have like their default forums, so you'll see people posting in there, like, hey, add me. But the main way is, one of the first things we added to try to build the online community was a global lobby.
Okay.
So instead of just listing games, because when we came from Xbox, we kind of just copied like our interface from Xbox Live.
Yep.
Which is kind of, it's a lot better for games that have a million players, and it's not so good for games that have, you know, a couple dozen.
Yep.
So we made a global lobby with like a chat window, so everyone can chat in the same lobby, and it shows you who's there.
Yep.
So that was one of our first tweaks.
So you like mentioned numbers before, and that's a good point I wanted to touch on as well. A lot of people often think, oh, success is when I have 100,000 concurrent users, right? And for most studios, in particular games, that's not very reasonable, right? So developers can still make a living, and a very good living, off having a smaller smaller community who are wildly passionate and feel heard, right, about what they're doing. So I'm glad you brought that up too, because I've spoken with other developers as well who've said, you know, we only have a few thousand players at most, but they end up coming back over and over again, and they're communicating and they're building mods or wanting more. So you can still have a great fan base who's wildly passionate. So the end numbers, the total numbers are not always relevant, right? It's the seeing the forest through the trees and understanding that you can have 100,000 users, but if only 500 are actually passionate about it and the rest are trolls or don't really care about the product, that's not much value there, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and with niche games too, a lot of the things you can charge higher amounts for than most indie games, because indie games always have a lower price point than AAAs, which is
it's like makes a race to the bottom.
Yeah. And it makes it really hard to survive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Especially because I think people don't realize that it's not, you know, you buy a game for $10, we don't see $10.
Right. Uncle Sam gets his cut. The App Store gets their cut. If you're using middleware, often you have to pay the licensing fee for that.
Yeah.
Tools that you're using, right? If you're using, you know, Adobe Creative Cloud, that's not free. Maya and Max are not free. Yeah. So it all
royalties
costs money.
And...
Yep. You need office space and you need a computer to build this game and this tool. So.
Mm-hmm. And then you pay for a trailer usually. I mean,
yeah, right. Yeah. Yep. So all this has to come from somewhere. So you've got to recuperate these costs. And in terms of pricing, like what are you charging for this? And the reason I ask real quick is because I have an 8-year-old at home and he's frequently playing on tablet. And he has an Android tablet and he'll see a game for $1 or $2. And he thinks, this is crazy. I would never pay this. And I was like, no, this costs money. But we just got him a Wii U for Christmas, and he loves Mario Maker and Mario Kart. Mario Maker, that was $60. I said, man, look, this was 60 times more than that dollar game you bought over there, right? So I think for younger people, or at least folks getting into gaming and who are growing up with touch-first interface, it's a very different world. So can you share what you think about pricing?
I think a lot of it, like, he probably isn't upset that Mario Maker costs $60. And part of that, I think people just don't want to get – they don't want to feel like they got suckered.
Yep.
And, you know, people know that a Wii U game costs $60 and a mobile game can be, you know, free.
Yep.
So the expectations there are a lot different. And so on Steam, fortunately, there's still this expectation that games cost a little bit of money. Unfortunately, it follows a high-low pricing model, like kind of like fashion retail, right?
So, right.
Most games by units are sold on a sale. I actually had a chart in my post on that, too. I think we sold about half of our games at 25%.
Oh, I see. Yeah, percentage of full price.
Yeah.
Yeah, so average copy of average cost of $3.62. Not cost. You recuperated $3.62 per copy, right?
Yeah, that was the list price. So, we don't even get that much, right?
Right. Again, it gets cut up again.
Yeah. So it's a $10 game. All three of our abstract strategy games are $10. Piece, $9.99. Our hardcore Euro game is even more niche, so that one's going to have a higher price. The MSRP of the board game that we're porting is almost $100. So
wow. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, and it's a trade off too, right? Because people don't have a tangible item in their hand, but at the same time, they have something that's ultimately very convenient and a digital copy that they can, you know, replicate across devices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's. It was a concern too. The people we're licensing from, they don't want it because the board game is almost $100. That's a pretty big barrier even for board gamers.
Definitely, but they don't want to devalue that product either, right?
Yeah. So we can't charge. I mean, if we sold our game on Steam for $10, that would make people have to think really long and hard before getting the tabletop version.
Yep.
So.
And you know, people think this all the time when they go between console and Steam, right? Looking at Battlefront, Star Wars Battlefront is $10 more on consoles than it is on Steam. Same with the latest Call of Duty. So people think, is it worth it for that $10 extra, right?
Yeah. Yep. I mean, people got to remember when they were gamers, you know, like I'm cheap. I'm like overpaying for games. If I was I'm still an actual consumer of Steam games and I do wait for them to go on sale.
Yeah. Hey, those Steam sales, you know, work wonders for people, right?
Yeah.
But think about how many, new franchises that opens people up to as well, right? You look at like Star Wars just had a big bundle on Steam and they could sell like 15 games for $27. And a lot of those were games, you know, like, Dark Forces, right? Like use the modified version of the Doom engine. And that's, you know, more than 20 years old. And all of a sudden it's reaching new audiences because it's going for 75 cents and a dollar. So,
yeah.
Interesting to see how prices fluctuate over time on some of these games.
Yeah, I'm hoping they stabilize a bit on Steam, because I went through the whole race to the bottom on XBLIG,
yep.
And that was, I mean, it was an absolute race to the bottom. Like, it ended up where all games were expected to be $1.
Yeah. and it's a shame, because it kills it for so many developers. I'm very active in a lot of these communities, and I have hardware and software from all the platforms. Right? I'm recording this from a MacBook Pro, and I have an iPhone next to me. And a post I recently read, I think from Marco Arment, who wrote Instant Paper and a whole bunch of other things. And what he was saying is a lot of the app stores aren't friendly to developers, in that you look at something like the iPad app store, right? So iOS store. Someone was creating like a high-end art program, right, where you could draw with a pen on their tablet. And typically this would go for, you know, $50, $60, or $70 on like a desktop machine. And it was the same software. But because it was on a mobile device, they essentially had to make it free, because people were not going to pay money for it, right? The number of people paying $10 for something was outrageous. But if he sold that exact same item on a Mac instead of an iPad, he could sell it at $60. but having things like not the inability to have demos, I know there's trials, but that's completely different, right? Mm-hmm. It kind of makes a lot of these marketplaces difficult for people, because your only chance of ever getting seen on the front of these stores is to make it free, to then increase the number of downloads or sales, which will then get you put in the front, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, Steam's done a pretty good job defending the developers from this kind of onslaught. So, I mean, it's one of the reasons that they're dragging their heels with Greenlight and just opening the floodgates completely, is because they know that if Steam ends up being like the iTunes App Store or whatever, and releasing 1,000 games a day,
yeah,
it's going to be extremely hard for indies to get any traction at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I could make mobile versions of all of these board games. FNA can run,
yep,
on Android, and we can make it run on iOS and stuff, but it's just the thing of, you know, I'd make like $200 and spend 6 months on it. Like,
right.
So it's a pretty big risk. It's something we might experiment with to see if, you know, maybe board games are an exception, but in general, indies, it's very easy to get swallowed up.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm looking at the front of the Steam store right now, and so popular new releases, right, showing me four free-to-play games, but the rest, some are full price at $10. Another game is Chiptune Champion. It's off 20% off at $8. So they kind of have a little bit of everything. What I also like is they have Steam curators, right, who are recommending different titles, and a bunch of them are $60 titles I'm seeing. They have specials kind of listed off to the side, under $10. And then finally, you can add like your own wish list, and it'll kind of customize and say, based on the things that you like, here are other titles, but even tags recommended for you. So I play a lot of Warhammer games, so I can click on that tag, or RTS or single player. So you're right. I think Steam does a very good job of understanding what it is that I like and I enjoy, and kind of servicing that, mm-hmm, while still giving me an opportunity to explore other titles, right? So it's not just a generic storefront, although perhaps half of it is. The other half is kind of catered towards me and what they think I might enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that does a lot to slow down the race to the bottom. Like, I still think it will go race to the bottom. Like, the prices, I'll bet,
yep,
that people are playing are paying are still decreasing, but mm-hmm, it'll slow it down, give us another couple of years, which is like a lot in video game time. Like,
yeah.
The history of video games, like, everything changes every 5 years, so...
Yeah, really.
Yeah, the fact that I can still sell on Steam the same games I was selling on Steam a couple of years ago is already very relaxing.
Yeah. Oh no, I know. And this game looks cool. The park, set in a creepy amusement park, hiding in the dark, sinister hideout. Okay. And I'm going to add this to my list, so I have something to check out later on too. So I mean, even in fact, they have things like wish lists, right? So friends can buy it for me, or they can see what I'm interested in. Like, that's pretty neat to me as well.
Yeah, and they'll email you when it's on sale, which
perfect.
Huge.
Right, as a developer, you must love that, right? Because people can see, like, okay, this is definitely what I'm into. Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. And then when we run our sales, like, that gives us visibility. Because, like, we get very little press,
yep,
which is primarily my fault from never reaching out to press. But
that's a whole show for another day.
Yeah, But the fact that we can, you know, when we have a sale and an update and we wrap them together, because you can actually, you can associate them.
Oh, nice. So that's why you'll have your new players who are also playing with your veterans,
mm-hmm.
right? And they could see like, hey, there's actually a community behind this.
Yeah, and it'll show them like, this game's on sale for 75% and here's what's new in it. So, and just the fact that there is anything new in it is a good sign to players, I think. And I think they like, they buy more when we group the two together.
Yeah.
And Steam will give us visibility around that, which is good because, you know, it's not something like on mobile. If you release an update, no one's going to know about it.
Yeah, exactly. Seriously.
So,
it's tough, especially, I recently went back to iPhone and like, I get so many notifications and push updates that, it all kind of gets lost in one big shuffle.
Mm-hmm. And if it's a game that you haven't bought, it's not like you go to the store. It's not going to be like, oh,
yeah,
this,
I have no
this,
idea.
Yeah, this game released its 80th update and is on sale. It's like, yeah, but there's like literally hundreds of thousands that were just updated today.
Yeah.
Are on sale.
Okay, so, how does this get to me?
Yeah.
All right. So we've covered quite a bit today. I got some great notes on this, so I'll put in the show. So now we're wrapping things up.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know, do you have a question for the next developer who will be on this show? And again, you won't know who this person is yet. I'm actually recording that show later on this week with another individual. But do you have a question that you would like for them to answer regarding the games industry?
Sure. I would say, if you knew then what you know now, what's the one thing you would have done differently from the start?
That's always good, right? Always hindsight.
Yeah.
All right. If you knew then what you know now, what would you have done differently? And there's quite a few things I would have liked to have done differently too. But hindsight, always 20/20. And I mean, even you sharing your knowledge in that postmortem is invaluable, right? And that's marketing in and of itself, right? Because you can post on Gama Sutra on your own blog. And even me going to your blog at bluelinegamestudios.com, I can see that you wrote this December 6th. Okay, so a month ago, you wrote this. Mm-hmm. And that's great for users because now they're going to go in and see, okay, clearly this person's supporting what they're doing. If they, you know, they're updating their blog every month. You have a bunch of other content here about writing with FNA and Monogame. So you're attracting not only the users, but also the developers, other developers who might be interested in what you're doing too. So you're bringing a lot of value there.
Yeah, hopefully it works out. The postmortem took me like a week to write full time.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's like, it's not easy, but at the same time, right. It's marketing material. It's lessons mm-hmm. learned for you. It's an opportunity mm-hmm. for you to submit that as a speech or a talk at other industry events. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which will then hopefully lead to more contacts and connections.
Yeah. I mean, that data, I didn't have it in a good format. That's one of the reasons it took so long is I had to chop up the sales data that we got. And so mm-hmm. I learned a lot just by making those charts because I'd never seen those charts. I had kind of an idea by looking at the data,
yep.
but visualizing it, it helped me a lot too.
Right. Kind of reaffirmed what you already knew, but also taught you quite a bit of new information along the way too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. So now we're coming around the home stretch, final part. What are you working on now or what's in the near future? Like, what can you share with us about the future plans and products of your studio?
Okay. So I guess we have a side project that I'm hoping in 6 months I'll have in an alpha.
Okay. 6 months, kinda, long lead time for an indie studio.
Yeah, that's a side project. And then our main project, but I've been working on that side project for, oh God, like a year now. Mm-hmm. But so I might invite you to my alpha.
At some point.
Yeah. And our main project is a Euro game that's, it's going to take us a year to write because there's so much more in depth than like abstract strategy games in yeah. terms of the sheer number of rules and edge cases and things.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't have the contract finalized. We have a letter of intent and we've agreed on terms, but it's still in the lawyer phase.
Okay.
So I will tell you it's one of the top three or four rated board games on Board Game Geek. So
Board Game Geek, you said?
So there's all the board games. There's like a million people on there and they rate board games. And
oh, nice.
One of the top three or four of all time. So it's pretty huge get for us. It's just, it's going to take a year total. We've been working on it for 3 or 4 months now.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in that long slog of like, you know, just mountains of code and nothing that we can show people yet.
That's all right. That's all right. But like, you know, you need those side projects to kind of keep your sanity and keep you interested in the things you do enjoy, right? Because making games is definitely still fun, but it does feel like what it is at times, and that's work, right?
Yeah. There's definitely parts of it that are, long chunks of work without the payback, but we've gotten good at suffering through those. It's kind of like, distance running in a way. you train for it and it gets a little easier.
Yep. Awesome. Well, Sean, thank you again for joining us, and I'd love to have you on again. I've done this with other guests in the past, so I'd like to follow up, down the road, see what else you've learned along the way, and hopefully you can share with us what this side project is the next time we have you on.
So sounds great.
If people want to find out more about you and reach out, what is the best way to get in touch with you, either through Twitter, what's your handle there, what is your blog address, things of that nature?
Our blog's bluelinegamestudios.com. It's been mostly a lot of game dev type stuff and like kind of a peek behind the curtain. And then on Twitter, we're Blue Line Games. That's kind of a company account. And then I have a personal account, which is just Sean Colombo, S-E-A-N.
Yep.
C-O-L-O-M-B-O. Kind of weird spelling. But I'm going to be trying to use the personal account more this year because I guess that's what people use.
Yeah, definitely. I am on there all the time too.
Yeah, I've been using the Blue Line Games account kind of as a personal account, and it's confusing people.
Yeah.
And they want to see the mohawk from what I've heard. No,
yeah. Oh yeah. You have a great blue mohawk that you bring out from time to time.
Yeah. So, it's the blue line in the hair form. So
I like it. Well, hence the blue line. It makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Well, great. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll have you on here again.
Yep. Thanks for having me, man.
No problem.
See you later.
See you. We'll be right back.